It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, with the Indiana primary behind us and the presidential field narrowing down even more, will you vote for your party's candidate even if you don't like the nominee all that much? We'll take your calls coming up.
First, we're going to stick with the Indiana primary, where both parties received some big news.
First, there was Republican hopeful Ted Cruz.
With a heavy heart, but with boundless optimism for the long-term future of our nation, we are suspending our campaign.
And then, though the polls indicated otherwise, Bernie Sanders emerged victorious over Hillary Clinton.
I understand that Secretary Clinton thinks that this campaign is over. I've got some bad news for her.
So Bernie Sanders staying in the race, but Ted Cruz dropped out last night. John Kasich on his way out today. Joining us now to talk about the Indiana primaries and what shape the races are in, we have Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, Cruz, his last best hope was Indiana. The polls at some point showed he had a shot. What happened?
I think a number of things happened, but momentum. I think that, you know, Donald Trump won over 50% of the vote in the Northeast primaries that occurred over the past few weeks. There was a real feeling within the Republican Party that they wanted to coalesce, get ready for the general election. And then I wouldn't dismiss that many voters, it seemed, were turned off by that Cruz-Kasich deal that they tried to put in place in Indiana, where Kasich would leave the state to Cruz. And ultimately what happened was a clear Donald Trump victory by double digits.
A lot of people were hoping, in the Republican Party, were hoping for a contested convention. Do you think that that was part of the thing here, that people were voting against that idea, saying whether we like Trump, we don't like Trump, we don't want a chaotic convention?
Maybe, although one could also argue that once Paul Ryan took his hat out of the ring, they realized that a contested convention could only result in Ted Cruz being the nominee. And I think what you saw was voters may not like Donald Trump, but they really, Republican voters for the most part, did not like Ted Cruz either. And they disliked Cruz more than Trump, and ergo, Trump, your nominee.
It makes you wonder, what if a strong Republican candidate not named Ted Cruz had been the one still in the race at this point, a Marco Rubio, say? Do you think that the Stop Trump campaign might have had a better shot?
I think it would have. I mean, if you just look at where Ted Cruz's votes were coming from, they were overwhelmingly from the very conservative part of the party. In fact, if you look at moderate and liberal voters in almost all of the states, with the exceptions being Wisconsin and Indiana, moderate and liberal voters went more for John Kasich or Marco Rubio when he was in the race than they went for Ted Cruz. Cruz was simply put a factional candidate, and when you're a factional candidate, you can't win a primary.
Well, here's Donald Trump. He buried Ted Cruz, and then he praised him last night.
What Ted did is really a very brave thing to do, and a great thing to do, because we want to bring unity to the Republican Party. We have to bring unity. It's so much easier if we have it.
Also said he was a tough fighter in the campaign. That great thing Ted Cruz did was drop out of the campaign and leave the path clear for Donald Trump. How likely is it now, Harry, that Donald Trump just comes into the convention with that 1237 delegates county needs or more?
I mean, he is going to get to the 1237. There's no doubt about it. I think when Ted Cruz looked at the math, he saw that, and that's why he dropped out. John Kasich later today, obviously, is also going to drop out per all the reports we're hearing. He also saw the math on the wall. But the real question is whether or not voters who are not fans of Donald Trump but who are Republicans are willing to forgive Trump for the comments he made, especially towards Cruz, just, you know, yesterday, basically saying that Ted Cruz's father was somehow associated with Lee Harvey Oswald. That's a pretty strong strike against Donald Trump in the eyes of many Republican voters.
Right, and that's where we are now for Republicans. We're seeing here in Wisconsin Scott Walker saying, Donald Trump's the candidate. He's better than Hillary Clinton. He'll back him. We have our state Senate majority leader saying, Donald Trump's the person. We're on the Trump train. Cruz, delegates in Wisconsin, you should switch. You should vote for Trump. Cruz should release you. We've seen other national Republicans saying, nope, not going to do it. We'll sit out or even vote for Hillary Clinton. So what's the conversation on that now?
I think, you know, at the end of the day, most people who identify as Republicans are going to vote for Donald Trump, but there are fewer self-identified Republicans than self-identified Democrats in this country. You need a united Republican electorate, and right now they are split. I would not be surprised if Trump only got, say, 85% of self-identified Republicans in the general election, and that would just be a non-starter. But let's wait and see. You know, primaries cause wounds, and time heals wounds. So we'll see what happens.
And what do you think about down ballot? Democrats hoping to retake the U.S. Senate, longer shots, maybe picking up seats in the House. How does Donald Trump affect that?
Well, I mean, we have seen an increasingly strong relationship between the Senate results that occur in a state and the presidential results. So, you know, Donald Trump is not particularly strong in either Wisconsin, Illinois, New Hampshire, Ohio, Florida. If the Democrats can win the open seats or the Republican seats in those states, they would be able to take back majority in the House. It's a longer road to hoe with. They need 30 seats. But, hey, if Hillary Clinton wins by the margin, the average margin of the polls right now nationally have her ahead 7 points. If she wins by that margin, I think the House could be in play in such a scenario.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com, looking at the Indiana primary results and a lot of news happening since then. Let's switch to the Democratic side now, Harry. Hillary Clinton had led in a lot of polls. Sanders ends up with a win, not a huge win, not a Donald Trump-sized win, but a win.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the polls were off. Not a single one of the Indiana polls had Bernie Sanders winning, but the polls this season on the Democratic side have not been that accurate. And, in fact, if you look back, the average poll miss in this particular primary was about 12 percentage points, maybe 13. That's pretty much in line with the average poll miss in previous primaries, so not a huge shock. But, again, it's all about delegates, and Bernie Sanders is right now down more than 280 elected delegates to Hillary Clinton. He would need to win something like 65% of the vote from here on out. And looking at the states, that just does not seem plausible.
Let's give a listen to Bernie Sanders last night saying, hey, the delegate count isn't great, but we have, he says, a path to victory. Here he is.
Then we're going to Kentucky and we're going to Oregon. We think we have a pretty good chance to win there as well. And then we're going to another bunch of other states, culminating in the largest state in the United States with the most delegates. And that is the state of California, and we think we have a pretty good chance to win there.
How big would he have to win in places like California and some of the other states he mentioned to actually close this gap?
He'd have to win in California by at least 25 percentage points, and there is not a single poll that has him leading in that state right now. I mean, look, wins are nice, and he will win some primaries. He could win in Kentucky. He'll probably win in Oregon. He'll probably win in West Virginia. But they just do not have enough delegates left. And he is not winning these states by a large enough margin that he can realistically close the gap in any meaningful way. In fact, I wouldn't be shocked looking at the California polls if Hillary Clinton ends up with more elected delegates than she has right now in terms of the lead that she has over Sanders.
And again, the lead that Hillary Clinton has, she has a lead even if you don't count superdelegates.
That's correct. She has a lot more people have voted for Hillary Clinton than Bernie Sanders this cycle. The superdelegates, yes, she has a lead among them too, but she also has a clear lead among elected delegates.
And Sanders supporters pointing to the Obama-Clinton race 8 years ago saying, oh, Obama was behind at this point, or that they're looking at the margins. How does this compare to 8 years ago?
Barack Obama held a lead in the elected delegate count since February, as a matter of fact, February of 2008 onwards, and he held that lead. Hillary Clinton has held the lead since February, and there isn't any sign that she is going to give up that lead. Bernie Sanders and Barack Obama were completely different positions, and Hillary Clinton right now is actually in a stronger position than Barack Obama was, even when Tim Russert declared 8 years ago that he was going to be the presumptive nominee.
So we've got an almost certain nominee, it looks like, on the Republican side, a very, very likely one on the Democratic side. Thoughts looking ahead, Harry, at Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump for the next handful of months?
I honestly feel bad for the voters. You know, these are two candidates historically disliked. Hillary Clinton be the most disliked candidate at this point since at least 1980, except for the fact that Donald Trump is even more disliked than she is. This is a negative campaign. It's a choice. This is a clear choice of a lesser of two evils. But Hillary Clinton right now is the lesser of two evils. Even if she's seen negatively, Donald Trump is seen far more negatively.
Right. Do they both have net negatives, meaning when you subtract their positives minus the people who actively dislike them, they're both in the hole there?
They're both in the hole. And in fact, over 50% of voters have a strongly unfavorable view of Donald Trump. I have never seen that. The only politician who's comparable is David Duke. And that's not a person, if I was Donald Trump, I want to be compared to.
And as we go through the campaign here and as we wrap up, I mean, is there a whole lot that we don't know about these candidates that the campaign's going to reveal? I mean, nothing, there's not going to be much that's going to make us think better or worse of them, I wouldn't think.
I wouldn't think. You never know. Maybe some Republicans call us around Trump and some Democrats call us around Clinton, but I think we're in it for the long haul in terms of negativity. If you like negativeness, this is the campaign for you.
Huh. Well, Harry, thanks as always. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. He joined us to talk about yesterday's Indiana primary. Donald Trump wins and looks like he's the guy. Bernie Sanders won, but he's still got a long road before he would have a chance at coming back.
And we want to hear from you. With Trump as the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party and Hillary Clinton getting closer to clinching the Democratic nomination, are you willing to support them in the general election, even if they're not your preferred candidate? Or will you switch parties and vote against them? Or will you just stay home? We want to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, UW Oshkosh staff have been traveling to remote Wyoming to provide instruction at the Wind River Tribal College. We'll learn about the Northern Arapaho Teacher Education Program.
Right now, we want to hear from you. Ted Cruz has dropped out of the GOP race. Kasich, John Kasich, is on his way out, leaving Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party. And Hillary Clinton is still ahead of Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side.
With the field rapidly narrowing and previous allegiances being tested, if you've been an ardent supporter of Ted Cruz, will you vote for Donald Trump? Or if Sanders exits the race, will you vote for Hillary Clinton? Or would you be so unsatisfied with your choices that you'd stay home? We want to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll start things off with Brett calling from Green Bay. Brett, hi.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I believe Bernie Sanders, you saw what happened last night with what happens when there are actual open primaries and the masses are allowed to vote for him. He can win. But the way the Democratic system is set up, a lot of his voters get closed out and suppressed. And basically through this whole election, I've seen the way Hillary is and basically a puppet, you know, and I'd never vote for her. I used to be a Clinton fan. I thought the 90s were good, but so, they learned about trade deals and whatnot.
So, Brett, when it comes to Election Day in November, what do you do if it's Clinton versus Trump?
Basically, I think Bernie Sanders is our only hope for the future of goodness of mankind. And if he isn't in, I think we're screwed either way. But the way Hillary Clinton won with voter suppression, I'd rather vote for Trump any day.
Brett, thanks for your call. We're taking your calls. If it is Trump against Clinton come Election Day, how do you vote? Will you vote for your party's candidate, even if they weren't your first choice, even if you were part of a movement to stop them in the primaries? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go back to the phones and Lucian in Waukesha. Hi, what do you have to say?
Hi, I just wanted to call and allude what the last caller just said, too. He makes perfect sense about how the open primaries, I mean, you guys just had a guest on that was saying that that he didn't understand the polls have been off, like, on the Democratic side for Bernie Sanders. But, like, he should be able to figure it out that when we have open primaries, he wins, like, every time, I think. He also alluded to the point that he actually laughed and said that Bernie Sanders has way less votes than Hillary Clinton. And they're not telling you, but they're not counting votes from caucus states. I don't think that's part of his. They can't count votes from caucus states, and he's like winning those hands down too.
So it sounds like you're saying that you would not be willing to vote for Hillary Clinton no matter what.
Never, never in a million years. And there's like a million progressives out there just like me that we will never vote for her because she doesn't hold any actual progressive values.
All right, Lucian, thank you so much for that call.
Yeah, thanks. And I had seen some reporting earlier that Clinton actually had won more open primary states than Bernie Sanders so far. We'll go back to our callers now. Elizabeth is on the line in Richland Center. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Like I told your person that answered your phone, I would never write Donald Trump in as a president because I think he is just, he's a bully, and he's just very offensive. And whatever he says, he's very offensive.
And Elizabeth, are you usually a Republican voter, Democratic, or you might go either way on a given campaign?
I am a Democrat, and I just feel that experience is what this country needs. And I know a lot of people like Bernie Sanders, even my teenage granddaughter. And I just don't know how he can promise all this stuff and get it pushed through the Congress the way it is right now.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts.
And we had a Facebook comment from Nathan. He says, I generally tend to vote Republican, but with Trump as the nominee, I think I'll have to switch parties this fall. I'll be voting Libertarian. When the two parties offer us these options, it's pretty easy to see that it's time for a third party. And so, Rob, that's another option that people might not stay home, but
might vote. A third party or write in. Well, how about you? We're asking now that it's things seem to be settling in, Donald Trump on the Republican side, Hillary Clinton a commanding lead in delegates on the Democratic side, very likely candidate. So how would you vote if you disliked them? Would you still unite with your party and vote for them or find another path, not vote at all? You can join in. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The number one and number two most negatively viewed candidates at this stage in a race appear to be the most likely candidates on your ballots in November.
And let's go back to the phones. And Christopher in Chippewa Falls is next. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What do you have to say?
I mean, I've been a Bernie Sanders supporter from the beginning, and at this point, there's no way I would ever vote for Hillary Clinton. I would have to vote for Trump. So, I mean, I can't trust her. I can't get behind her campaign or her brand name.
And so, do you trust Trump? And what is it about Trump that you see as being closer to your values Bernie supporter?
I see him as being more genuine. I can actually believe some of the things he says, even if I don't agree with them. And in the end, I want a genuine person in the White House.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that call, Christopher. Interesting mix, Rob. People who will go to the other party, will go to a third party.
We'll stay the same. We're looking for you now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Is there a candidate, by the way, that you would have preferred one on the Republican side? If you're a Republican, was there somebody you were disappointed when they dropped out of the campaign, whether it was today, last night, or over the last few months? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And again, that's 800-642-1234. And you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's go back to the phones. And David in Ironwood. Hi.
Yes, I'm thinking Green Party because, you know, it's about time. I mean, of any election right now, I mean, now is the time for a third party to come in. If someone else decides to run as an independent, that is, well, you know, be it Sanders or someone else, I think they would have a good chance of winning.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call, David. Hearing that a lot from Sanders supporters, and there are questions whether, if it is Hillary Clinton, the party can reunite there. And, of course, a lot of big questions on the Republican side. If it's Trump, and it looks like it will the Stop Trump campaign turn into the Stop Clinton campaign in the fall?
Let's go back to the phones, and Richard in Monroe is up next. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter. Probably pull the pin on the hand grenade and vote for Trump if Hillary Clinton became the president or became the nominee. Or I probably would vote for Jill Stein. She's got ovaries and she doesn't lie.
So going Green Party, third party, Green Party instead. Richard, what would make you decide which way you were going to go, whether you were going to go for Trump or for a third party like Jill Stein?
I don't know. I'm the political process is so mired. You guys talk about the horse race. You never talk about the track conditions, about how voting and voter suppression amongst the Democratic Party is amazing. How Bernie always wins when they're independents allowed to vote, and Hillary wins when, you know, just the registered Democrats are supposed to vote. So in a general election, obviously, Bernie would destroy Trump, and then he's someone I can trust.
Gotcha. Thanks, Richard, for the call. Chris with us next in Belleville. Chris, hi.
Hi there. I want to say that I'm a Bernie supporter, and I really agree with what everybody's saying about how the system is rigged and so forth against him and other candidates like him. But I will vote for Hillary if I have to. And the reason is I think people are losing sight of the fact that we're not going to change the way that the system works here with just one candidate or one election. This is a movement, and a revolution takes a long time to occur. And just like Bernie Sanders, you know, didn't give up when he lost elections and didn't give up when he had something to do, he kept trying. That's what we need to do, too. And under a Democratic regime, frankly, people's lives will be a little bit better than they will be under Trump or someone else. So that's why I'm voting for Hillary if I have to.
All right, Chris, thanks for that call. Time for one more. Daryl in Green Bay. Daryl, hi.
Yeah, I was a Jeb Bush supporter. Then he dropped out, of course. And I couldn't get behind the other Republican candidates as I found them too extreme, very, very, very right-wing extreme. So,
thanks for all your calls. You can keep making your comments on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, we learn about an unlikely partnership between UW Oshkosh and a teacher training program for Native Americans in Wyoming. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out why drug-related arrests are down in Milwaukee and up in many other communities throughout the state.
First, UW Oshkosh is home to one of the first teacher preparation programs in the state, graduating its first class in 1871. But in just the past few years, they've taken on a new, unique program to provide instructors to a tribal college in Wyoming to help students attain bachelor's degrees and fulfill the requirements to teach in their home state.
Joining us to discuss the Northern Arapaho Teacher Education Program is Susan Finkel-Hoffman. She's the Interim Director of Outreach for the Department of Special and Early Childhood Education at UW Oshkosh, and she's one of the coordinators for the Northern Arapaho Teacher Education Program. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So I think the first question that comes to mind is, how did UW Oshkosh come to partner with Wind River Tribal College, which is in very rural Wyoming?
You're right. It is very rural Wyoming. There's lots of stories about how the connection happened. The Tribal College was working originally trying to find a university to partner with in terms of having their education courses being connected with a university that could transcript them. The Tribal College is not an accredited college yet, and so they needed to connect with something. And they just kept working their way west until they got to UW-La Crosse. And UW-La Crosse said, well, we can't work with you, but we know this dean over at UW Oshkosh, and that dean was a former dean of the College of Letters and Science here. And so they made their way here and began working with Oshkosh in having courses dual listed that they were offering out there so that students could get a transcript. As they were having that conversation, they also said, hey, you know, we're thinking about applying for these teacher ed grants. Is this something that you'd be interested in working with us on? Or, you know, can we talk with you about this experience? Because we had just finished a partnership with the College of Menominee Nation around a similar grant. And so we had this meeting, and, you know, the folks from the Tribal College came to Wisconsin, and we talked about teacher education and how we structured our program. My colleague, Suzanne Damel, was working with the College of Menominee Nation grant, and so she was able to talk about her experiences with that grant, and, you know, they left and said, well, thank you, this was very helpful, and we didn't hear from them again until about 5 years later, when we got a call that they were coming back because they had finally received a grant. This is one of those grants where apparently you have to write it a number of times before you're actually awarded the grant. Mm.
And so, you know, planning to teach courses and support students is always a big job. Yesterday was Teacher Appreciation Day, and I think a lot of us know that, you know, it's a big job. But in this case, on top of all of those usual needs, there are a lot of logistical issues to take care of, too. Tell us, in a nuts and bolts way, how does this program work?
Well, you know, when Suzanne and I sat down to plan the program, we knew that there were some courses we would need. We could use local instructors out there. We hired some local teachers. We had, you know, connections out there for some instructors, but we would need to bring a lot of instructors from Oshkosh out to Wyoming. And in this particular area of the reservation, internet service is pretty spotty. And so we thought about doing courses online or, you know, using distance ed, but the technology just wasn't available out there to handle it. Plus, the students in the program are very, very much visual learners, and so we really wanted to plan a program that was where we would be there, where we would be hands-on, where we would build relationships with them, just like we do with our own students here in Oshkosh. So we just packed our suitcases and went out. You know, we went out knowing we were going to be doing full-day courses. And so when we were thinking about our first semester, we said, well, we'll do courses full days. Fine, that will work just fine. What time do you want to have the classes? And Suzanne and I said, well, 8 to 4, of course. You know, why wouldn't you have a class from 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock? That would be a full day. And we were told, oh, you know, that's really too early. So we said, well, what about 9 to 5? Oh, well, you know, 10 to 6 might be better. And so we ran our courses regularly from 10 o'clock to 6 o'clock. And there would be times where Suzanne would be teaching one course from 10 o'clock until 2 o'clock. We would have a lunch break and some study time. And then I would teach another class from 2 o'clock until 6 o'clock. And so we would, you know, get our course in. We would take turns cooking lunch and cleaning up the kitchen because food is a really important part of the learning process and building community. And so we had lunch every day when we were teaching, and we each had our recipes that we became known for, and we just did it.
Well, and I'm guessing, Susan, that part of the reason that starting later might have been a better idea is this is really kind of in the middle of nowhere, and I'm guessing that students might be traveling large distances.
Well, most of the students that we had in the program were really fairly local, within 30 miles of the tribal college, but there are also people that have really complicated lives outside of school. You know, they all are, many of them had children, you know, many of them are older. They're not a typical 18 or 19 or 20-year-old college student mm-hmm. with not, you know, very many responsibilities. You know, maybe you have a job or something, but these folks worked full-time, they had children, they had, you know, other families living together with them, mm-hmm. So we needed to be as flexible as we could. We also knew that there would be times that we would have their families with us in class. You know, people would bring in a child or a baby that wasn't feeling good, and, you know, or if a grandchild showed up and they needed to provide care for their grandchild, well, they would bring their child along to class. And, you know, we always had activities for somebody to sit in the back of the room doing some coloring or doing, you know, some other activities. They became a part of the class as well.
We're talking right now about the Northern Arapaho Teacher Education Program, which is a joint project between UW Oshkosh and the Wind River Tribal College in rural Wyoming. We've been talking with Susan Finkel-Hoffman from UW Oshkosh. Joining us now also is Gary Martin. He was born and raised in Gallup, New Mexico. He's Navajo and Jicarilla Apache. He settled in Wyoming to work in the Head Start program and did receive his teaching degree and licensure as part of the Northern Arapaho Teacher Education Program. Gary, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for this opportunity as well.
Well, Gary, you were part of that first cohort that went through the Northern Arapaho Teacher Education Program. How did you come to be part of that project?
I heard about it through work, and they were telling us about the requirements and everything. And I already had a degree, but I didn't have the degree that I wanted as far as education goes. And so I kind of had to wiggle my way into the program because they were basically looking for people who either had an associate's degree or were working on a bachelor's degree but didn't finish. So,
So Gary, yeah. what were your expectations going into this program?
Well, first of all, it was just the idea that I wanted to get my degree in education so I could further my opportunities.
And what kind of education were you hoping to go into? What age group were you hoping to teach?
Well, I have experience with junior high and working with the Head Start program. I had experience with that, and that's like a 3 to 5 year olds. Mm-hmm. And in elementary school, the only experience I had with the elementary was just I substituted one time for a friend of mine.
And Gary, going through the program, being part of this cohort of students, but also building relationships with these teachers who were coming from, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles away, what was the experience like for you? What did you take out of it, maybe that you didn't expect to?
The thing that I really took out of it, as besides getting the degree, is just the idea that we all became close because we were with each other for like 3 or 4 days at a time, and you got to know people and you got to get close to them. You know, it pretty much became a family, really.
And Susan, you said that many of the students are non-traditional. How did you and other UW Oshkosh instructors tailor your lesson plans and courses to students who are coming from a very different ethnic and geographic background, as well as having those life challenges that your average 20-year-old college student might not be facing?
You know, it was really and truly a natural thing for all of us. I think every single instructor who went out to Wyoming felt embraced by the students and by the community and the culture there. Suzanne and I would talk with instructors before they would go out and sort of, you know, give them the lay of the land. You know, well, you know, we say we're going to start a class at 10 o'clock, but it's going to be, you know, maybe at 10 o'clock you might have 2 or 3 folks there, and by 11 o'clock you'll have a full class. And, you know, talking about, you know, the learning style of the students and, you know, the rich experience that all of the people in the program brought to the program. Most of the folks who came through the program had already been working in schools and classrooms in one way or another, either as a Head Start teacher or as a paraprofessional in one of the elementary schools there. So they brought a lot of experience with them, and it just became really, really natural for all of us. That's the best way that I can describe it. For all of us, I mean, this was a program for the folks out there that was really life-changing for them, but I think for every instructor, it was life-changing as well.
And Gary, as we wrap up here, do you think if this program, if this partnership between Wind River Tribal College and UW Oshkosh didn't exist, do you think you'd be teaching today?
I would be teaching, but it would be... a little bit harder because it's like the nearest university from where I am is like 3 hours away.
So,
and there is like a junior college in Riverton, which is about maybe 30 miles away. But it's like this opportunity that we got through the college, through the tribal college, was something that I don't take for granted because it was, I know the instructors that came, they made the effort, and it was like it just made it that much more important for us to do what we could as far as like getting our degrees and everything.
Well, Susan, Gary, thanks so much for joining us today. Susan Finkel-Hoffman works at UW Oshkosh and is one of the coordinators for the Northern Arapaho Teacher Education Program. Gary Martin attended Wind River Tribal College as part of the first cohort of the Northern Arapaho Teacher Education Program.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we talk about why Wisconsin GOP leaders are unhappy about a UW-Madison faculty vote of no confidence aimed at UW system leadership.
First, according to recently published arrest data from the Wisconsin Department of Justice, there's a growing split between the Milwaukee Police Department and most other law enforcement agencies around the state when it comes to the number of drug-related arrests.
While the number of those arrests in Milwaukee have been declining in recent years, they've been ticking up throughout the rest of the state. The numbers come at a time when many communities are dealing with heroin and other opiate-related issues, including overdose deaths, which have increased in recent years.
Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He recently reported on these trends. Keegan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Milwaukee. What kind of decline are we talking about in drug arrests there?
It's really substantial, actually. Just over the past few years, so from like 2010 through 2014, the number of drug arrests have gone down by nearly 50%, from more than 6,000 a year to less than 3,300. It's a really dramatic drop that has significant, almost shifts the entire statewide trend in terms of drug arrests.
Right. If you look at, you wrote in your piece, if you look at the state as a whole, the overall numbers are going down, but that hides something. Milwaukee dropped a lot. What's happening in the rest of the state?
Across the rest of the state, the number of arrests have actually gone up by 11% over the same period. If you look at Milwaukee's drop, you lost about 2,800 arrests in 4 years, but across the rest of the state, you added about 2,200. So that's what I mean by when I talk about a split in drug arrests. Is in Milwaukee, you've seen this pretty dramatic decline, but a lot of that decline has been made up for by more arrests in other parts of the state.
Well, off the top of my head, I could see two ways to read that. A, there's less of a drug problem in Milwaukee now and more of a drug problem in the rest of the state. Or B, law enforcement is being done differently in Milwaukee than the rest of the state. As you dug into this, what did you see?
Yeah, I asked Milwaukee police about it, and they said there's been a conscious shift in strategies. They're not having patrol officers focused on drug arrests as much as they used to, and they're actually steering a lot more of their resources towards violent crime. That's definitely part of it. Across the rest of the state, as far as the increase, among the limited police departments that we've talked to, there's definitely at least anecdotal reports of increased drug use, increased attention on drug use. So those could be two common factors in why the number of drug arrests have gone up in other parts.
And I don't know how much the data spells this out, but do we know what kinds of drugs we're talking about? Is this a lot of marijuana arrests, or is this heroin and other opioids, meth? What goes into this?
Yeah, most of the drug arrests that are kind of contained in these statistics involve marijuana. And then a smaller amount is your opiates, cocaine, and synthetic drugs like methamphetamine. In Milwaukee, it's the drop has been pretty much uniform across those drug categories, but in other parts of the state, the rise in drug arrests has been most noticeable in like opiates and cocaine, but also in marijuana and things like that. So.
Talking to Keegan Kyle from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, about drug arrests on the state trends. A lot fewer of those arrests in Milwaukee, more of them, a rising number around the rest of the state. So going back to Milwaukee, and when you talked to the police department there, they're not saying we're not enforcing on drugs at all, right? How are they focusing drug-related investigations?
We didn't talk too much at length, but they still are, for example, participating in a regional task force that looks at drug crime. And they said they're still focusing on, like, high-level drug crimes. So you might be talking more about people who are selling drugs rather than, like, your users. So they're still trying to go after that type of problem in the community.
And you also heard from State Attorney General Brad Schimel on these trends. What did he have to say?
He declined to specifically address kind of this shift that the statistics show. But he did say that, you know, the state's approach to drug crime needs to be multifaceted. So not only, you know, should law enforcement be making arrests, but they should also be doing other things like, diverting people into treatment programs and making sure that there are resources and other ways to try to cut down on that type of issue.
Now, Keegan, when we've talked to you in the past about arrest data, I know you're interested not just in what the data tells us, but in the data itself, if it's reliable, if it's good. And you found that in at least one case, it's a little sketchy with what the state reported for, I think it was Eau Claire.
Right. The University of Eau Claire Police Department really stood out in some drug arrest statistics that we looked at. So I called up the police department and asked them to review their statistics. And they found that scores of arrests had been mistakenly reported to the state and really skewed their statistics, so it made it look like they had a much more aggressive crackdown on marijuana in particular than other UW police departments.
So do we have good numbers? Can we look at these numbers from the state when they say, here's how drug arrests are going, and think, okay, we've got a pretty comprehensive picture of what's really going on?
We're pretty reliant on trusting the accuracy of police agencies. So the state doesn't have a system to really check the authenticity of statistics that are reported by law enforcement agencies. The state just kind of accepts those statistics and publishes them online, kind of like a clearinghouse. And the federal government is the same way with its crime statistics. So if we want to look at the accuracy of statistics, we're left kind of going agency by agency and trying to look into that, like we did with UW Eau Claire. But the only reason we were able to do that is because it really stood out and there was something, an obvious question about whether what was going on.
And briefly, Keegan, is there any indication that there will be more standardization and streamlining so that these numbers can be more trustworthy?
I haven't really gotten into that issue, so I don't know. But it's a common question. I mean, I've been writing about crime statistics for years, and anytime you see a really bizarre trend, part of the question that you have to ask is, are these numbers reliable?
We'll leave it there for now, Keegan. Thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
That's Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He joins to talk about why drug arrests have declined in Milwaukee while they're rising almost everywhere else in the state and what is behind those numbers.
People are counting on us. The galaxy is counting on us.
Solo, we'll figure it out.
We'll use the Force. That's not how the Force works.
Han Solo and Finn aren't the only ones interested in the workings of the Force, especially today. It's a special holiday for Star Wars fans with the help of a little bit of mispronunciation.
It's May 4th, or May the 4th, which has been transformed into May the 4th be with you. Fans started celebrating May the 4th as Star Wars Day over the last 5 years or so. And starting in 2013, the Disney Company, owners of the Star Wars franchise, made it official.
Film screenings, reenactments, movie-themed costumes have all been a part of the celebrations for fans. And I imagine just a lot of people have been inspired to pull out the movie, watch it at home on this day.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking, so I saw the newest one.
Which I have not.
You have not. And you're a Star Wars person, like the originals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I say it's probably worth it. I was just thinking, maybe it's time. I should check it out again. Are you going to check it out anytime?
I want to check out the new one. I actually want to go back and watch the first few because I have lots of great memories. I was kind of like the prime demographic when they came out.
Well, me too, big time. But I showed it to my kids a while back. They liked it okay, but the special effects were so old-fashioned.
Too
low-tech for them.
Whereas we were all blown away.
I mean,
just by the opening sequence. That was enough to blow us away.
Out with a little of the newer Star Wars music here on Central Time.